The alarm got him up at 6:15. He took half an hour to bury Bump in the sandy patch of ground between the house and the lake, and by 7 he was rolling just as planned. He was 10 miles down the road and heading into Mechanic Falls, a bustling metropolis which consisted of a textile mill that had closed in 1970, 5,000 souls, and a yellow blinker at the intersection of Routes 23 and 7, when he noticed that his old Buick was running on fumes. He pulled into Bill's Chevron, cursing himself for not having checked the gauge before setting out. If he had gotten through Mechanic Falls without noticing how low the gauge had fallen, he might have had a pretty good walk for himself and ended up very late for his appointment with Amy. He went to the payphone in the wall while a pump jockey tried to fill the Buick's bottomless pit. He dug his battered address book out of his left rear pocket and dialed Greg Carstairs' number. He thought he might actually catch Greg in this early, and he was right. "Hello? Hi, Greg. Mort Rainey." "Hi, Mort. I guess you got some trouble up in Derry, huh?" "Yes," Mort said. "Was it on the news?" "Channel 5. "How did it look?"
"How did what look?"
Greg replied. Mort winced. But if he had to hear that from anybody, he was glad it had been Greg Carstairs. He was an amiable, long-haired ex-hippie who had converted to some fairly obscure religious sect, the Swedenborgians, maybe, not long after Woodstock. He had a wife and 2 kids, 1 7 and 1 5, and so far as Mort could tell, the whole family was as laid back as Greg himself. You got so used to the man's small but constant smile that he looked undressed on the few occasions he was without it.
"That bad, huh?"
"Yes," Greg said simply.
"It must have gone up like a rocket."
"I'm really sorry, man." "Thank you. I'm on my way up there now, Greg. I'm calling from Mechanic Falls. Can you do me a favor while I'm gone?"
"If you mean the shingles, I think they'll be in by..."
"No, not the shingles. Something else. There's been a guy bothering me the last 2 or 3 days, a crackpot. Claims I stole a story he wrote 6 or 7 years ago. When I told him I'd written my version of the same story before he claims to have written his, and told him I could prove it, he got wiggy. I was sort of hoping I'd seen the last of him, but no such luck. Last evening while I was sleeping on the couch, he killed my cat."
"Bump?"
Greg sounded faintly startled, a reaction that equaled roaring surprise in anyone else.
"He killed Bump?"
"That's right."
"Did you talk to Dave Newsom about it?"
"No, and I don't want to either. I want to handle him myself if I can."
"The guy doesn't exactly sound like a pacifist, Mort."
"Killing a cat is a long way from killing a man," Mort said. "And I think maybe I could handle him better than Dave."
"Well, it could have something there," Greg agreed. "Dave slowed down a little since he turned 70. What can I do for you, Mort?"
"I'd like to know where the guy is staying, for one thing."
"What's his name?"
"I don't know. The name on the story he showed me was John Shooter, but he got cute about that later on, told me it might be a pseudonym."
"I think it is. It sounds like a pseudonym.
Either way, I doubt if he's registered under that name if he's staying at an area motel."
"What does he look like?"
"He's about 6 feet tall and 40-something. He's got a kind of weather-beaten face, sun wrinkles around the eyes and lines going down from the corners of the mouth, kind of bracketing the chin." As he spoke, the face of John Shooter floated into his consciousness with increasing clarity, like the face of a spirit swimming up to the curved side of a medium's crystal ball. Mort felt goose flesh prick the backs of his hands and shivered a little. A voice in his midbrain kept muttering that he was either making a mistake or deliberately misleading Greg. Shooter was dangerous, all right. He hadn't needed to see what the man had done to Bump to know that. He had seen it in Shooter's eyes yesterday afternoon. Why was he playing vigilante then?
"Because,"
another deeper voice answered with a kind of dangerous firmness. "Just because, that's all." The midbrain voice spoke up again, worried.
"Do you mean to hurt him?
Is that what this is all about?
Do you mean to hurt him?"
But the deep voice would not answer. It had fallen silent.
"Sounds like half the farmers around here," Greg was saying doubtfully.
"Well, there's a couple of other things that might help pick him out," Mort said. "He's southern, for one thing. Got an accent on him that sticks out a mile. He wears a big black hat, felt, I think, with a round crown. It looks like the kind of hat Amish men wear. And he's driving a blue Ford station wagon, earlier mid-60s, Mississippi plates."
"Okay, better. I'll ask around. If he's in the area, somebody will know where. Out-of-state plates stand out this time of year. I know.
Something else crossed his mind suddenly. You might start by asking Tom Greenleaf. I was talking to this shooter yesterday on Lake Drive, about half a mile north of my place. Tom came along in a scout. He waved at us when he went by, and both of us waved back. Tom must have gotten a damn fine look at him.
Okay. I'll probably see him up at Bowie's store if I drop by for a coffee around 10.
He's been there too, Mort said. I know, because he mentioned the paperback book rack. It's one of the old-fashioned ones.
And if I track him down, what?
Nothing, Mort said. Don't do a thing. I'll call you tonight. Tomorrow night I should be back at the place on the lake. I don't know what the hell I can do up in Derry except scuffle through the ashes.
What about Amy?
She's got a guy, Mort said, trying not to sound stiff and probably sounding that way just the same.
I guess what Amy does next is something the two of them will have to work out.
Oh, sorry.
No need to be, Mort said.
He looked over toward the gas islands and saw that the jockey had finished filling his tank and was now washing the Buick's windshield, a sight he had never expected to witness again in his lifetime.
Handling this guy yourself, are you really sure that's what you want to do?
Yes, I think so, Mort said.
He hesitated, suddenly understanding what was very likely going on in Greg's mind. He was thinking that if he found the man in the black hat and Mort got hurt as a result, he, Greg, would be responsible.
Listen, Greg, you could go along while I talk to the guy if you wanted to.
I might do just that, Greg said, relieved.
It's proof he wants, Mort said, so I'll just have to get it for him.
But you said you had proof.
Yes, but he didn't exactly take my word for it. I guess I'm going to have to shove it in his face to get him to leave me alone.
Oh. Greg thought it over.
The guy really is crazy, isn't he?
Yes, indeed.
Well, I'll see if I can find him. Give me a call tonight.
I will, and thanks, Greg.
Don't mention it. A change is as good as a rest.
So they said.
He told Greg goodbye and checked his watch. It was almost 7:30, and that was much too early to call Herb Creekmore, unless he wanted to pry Herb out of bed, and this wasn't that urgent. A stop at the Augusta toll booths would do fine. He walked back to the Buick, replacing his address book and digging out his wallet. He asked the pump jockey how much he owed him.
It's $22.50 with the cash discount, the jockey said, and then looked at Mort shyly.
I wonder if I could have your autograph, Mr. Rainey. I have all your books.
That made him think of Amy again,
and how Amy had hated the autograph seekers.
Mort himself didn't understand them, but saw no harm in them. For her, they had seemed to sum up an aspect of their lives which she found increasingly hateful. Toward the end, he had cringed inwardly every time someone asked that question in Amy's presence. Sometimes he could almost sense her thinking, "If you love me, why don't you stop them?" As if he could, he thought. His job was to write books people like this guy would want to read, or so he thought. When he succeeded at that, they asked for autographs. He scribbled his name on the back of a credit slip for the pump jockey, who had, after all, actually washed his windshield, and reflected that if Amy had blamed him for doing something they liked, and he thought that on some level she herself might not be aware of she had, he supposed he was guilty. But it was only the way he had been built. Right was right, after all, just as Shooter had said, and fair was fair. He got back into his car and drove off toward Derry. He paid his 75 cents at the Augusta Toll Plaza, then pulled into the parking area by the telephones on the far side. The day was sunny, chilly, and windy, coming out of the southwest from the direction of Litchfield and running straight and unbroken across the open plain where the Turnpike Plaza lay. That wind was strong enough to bring tears to Mort's eyes. He relished it all the same. He could almost feel it blowing the dust out of rooms inside his head, which had been closed and shuttered too long. He used his credit card to call Herb Creekmore in New York, the apartment, not the office. Herb wouldn't actually make it to James and Creekmore, Morton Rainey's literary agency, for another hour or so. But Mort had known Herb long enough to guess that the man had probably been through the shower by now,
and was drinking a cup of coffee while he waited for the bathroom mirror to unsteam so he could shave. He was lucky for the second time in a row. Herb answered in a voice from which most of the sleep fuzz had departed. "Am I on a roll this morning or what?" Mort thought, and grinned into the teeth of the cold October wind. Across the four lanes of highway, he could see men stringing snow fence in preparation for the winter which lay just over the calendar's horizon. "Hi, Herb," he said. "I'm calling you from a pay telephone outside the Augusta Toll Plaza. My divorce is final. My house and dairy burned flat last night. Some nut killed my cat, and it's colder than a well-digger's belt buckle. Are we having fun yet?" He hadn't realized how absurd his catalog of woes sounded until he heard himself reciting them aloud, and he almost laughed. "Jesus, it was cold out here, but didn't it feel good? Didn't it feel clean?" "More?" Herb said cautiously, like a man who suspects a practical joke. "At your service," Mort said. "What's this about your house?" "I'll tell you, but only once. Take notes if you have to, because I plan to be back in my car before I freeze solid to this telephone." He began with John Shooter and John Shooter's accusation. He finished with the conversation he'd had with Amy last night. Herb, who had spent a fair amount of time as Mort and Amy's guest, and who had been entirely dismayed by their breakup, Mort guessed, expressed his surprise and sorrow at what had happened to the house in Derry. He asked if Mort had any idea who had done it. Mort said he didn't. "Do you suspect this guy Shooter?" Herb asked. "I understand the significance of the cat being killed only a short time before you woke up, but I guess it's technically possible, and I'm not ruling it out completely," Mort said. "But I doubt it like hell. Maybe it's only because I can't get my mind around the idea of a man burning down a 24-room house in order to get rid of a magazine. But I think it's mostly because I met him. He really believes I stole his story, Herb. I mean, he has no doubts at all. His attitude when I told him I could show him proof was, 'Go ahead, motherfucker, make my day.' Still, you called the police, didn't you?" "Yeah, I made a call this morning," Mort said, and while this statement was a bit disingenuous, it was not an out-and-out lie. He had made a call this morning to Greg Carstairs. But if he told Herb Creekmore, whom he could visualize sitting in the living room of his New York apartment in a pair of natty tweed pants and a strap-style T-shirt, that he intended to handle this himself, with only Greg to lend a hand, he doubted if Herb would understand. Herb was a good friend, but he was something of a stereotype. Civilized man, late 20th-century model, urban and urbane. He was the sort of man who believed in counseling, the sort of man who believed in meditation and mediation, the sort of man who believed in discussion when reason was present and the immediate delegation of the problem to persons in authority when it was absent. To Herb, the concept that sometimes a man has got to do what a man has got to do was one which had its place, but its place was in movies starring Sylvester Stallone. "Well, that's good." Herb sounded relieved. "You've got enough on your plate without worrying about some psycho from Mississippi. If they find him, what will you do? Have him charged with harassment?" "I'd rather convince him to take his persecution act and put it on the road," Mort said. His feeling of cheery optimism, so unwarranted but indubitably real, persisted. He supposed he would crash soon enough, but for the time being, he couldn't stop grinning. So he wiped his leaking nose with the cuff of his coat and went right on doing it. Ah, he'd forgotten how good it could feel to have a grin pasted onto your kisser. "How will you do that?" "With your help, I hope. You've got files of my stuff, right?" "Right, but, well, I need you to pull the June 1980 issue of Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine. That's the one with sewing season in it. I can't very well pull mine because of the fire, so..." "I don't have it," Herb said mildly. "You don't?" Mort blinked. This was the one thing he hadn't expected. "Why not?" "Because 1980 was 2 years before I came on board as your agent. I have at least one copy of everything I sold for you, but that's one of the stories you sold yourself." "Oh, shit." In his mind's eye, Mort could see the acknowledgement for sewing season and everybody drops the dime. Most of the other acknowledgements contain the line, "Reprinted by permission of the author and the author's agents, James and Creekmore." The one for sewing season and two or three other stories in the collection read only, "Reprinted by permission of the author." "Sorry," Herb said. "Of course I sent it in myself. I remember writing the query letter before I submitted it, just that it seems like you've been my agent forever. He laughed a little then and added, "No offense."
"None taken," Herb said.
"Do you want me to make a call to EQMM? They must have back issues."
"Would you?" Mort asked gratefully.
"That'd be great."
"I'll do it first thing, only..."
Herb paused.
"Only what?"
"Promise me you're not planning to confront this guy on your own once you have a copy of the printed story in hand."
"I promise," Mort agreed promptly. He was being disingenuous again, but what the hell? He had asked Greg to come along when he did it, and Greg had agreed, so he wouldn't be alone. And Herb Creekmore was his literary agent, after all, not his father. How he handled his personal problems wasn't really Herb's concern.
"Okay," Herb said, "I'll take care of it. Call me from Derry, Mort. Maybe it isn't as bad as it seems."
"I'd like to believe that."
"But you don't?"
"I'm afraid not."
"Okay," Herb sighed. Then diffidently he asked, "Is it okay to ask you to give Amy my best?"
"It is, and I will."
"Good.
You go on and get out of this wind, Mort. I can hear it shrieking in the receiver. You must be freezing."
"Getting there."
"Thanks again, Herb."
He hung up and looked thoughtfully at the telephone for a moment. He'd forgotten that the Buick needed gas, which was minor, but he'd also forgotten that Herb Creekmore hadn't been his agent until 1982, and that wasn't so minor. Too much pressure, he supposed. It made a man wonder what else he might have forgotten. The voice in his mind, not the midbrain voice, but the one from the deep ranges, spoke up suddenly.
"What about stealing the story in the first place? Maybe you forgot that."
He snorted a laugh as he hurried back to his car. He had never been to Mississippi in his life, and even now, stuck in a writer's block as he was a long way from stooping to plagiarism. He slid behind the wheel and started the engine, reflecting that a person's mind certainly got up to some weird shit every now and again. Mort didn't believe that people, even those who tried to be fairly honest with themselves, knew when some things were over. He believed they often went on believing, or trying to believe, even when the handwriting was not only on the wall, but written letters large enough to read 100 yards away without a spyglass. If it was something you really cared about and felt that you needed, it was easy to cheat. Easy to confuse your life with TV and convince yourself that what felt so wrong would eventually come right, probably after the next commercial break. He supposed that, without its great capacity for self-deception, the human race would be even crazier than it already was. But sometimes the truth crashed through, and if you had consciously tried to think or dream your way around that truth, the results could be devastating. It was like being there when a tidal wave roared not over but straight through a dike which had been set in its way, smashing it and you flat. Mort Rainey experienced one of these cataclysmic epiphanies after the representatives of the police and fire departments had gone, and he and Amy and Ted Milner were left alone to walk slowly around the smoking ruin of the green Victorian house which had stood at 92 Kansas Street for 136 years. It was while they were making that mournful inspection tour that he understood that his marriage to the former Amy Dowd of Portland, Maine, was over. It was no period of marital stress. It was no trial separation. It was not going to be one of those cases you heard of from time to time where both parties repented their decision and remarried. It was over. Their lives together were history. Even the house where they had shared so many good times was nothing but evilly smoldering beams tumbled into the cellar hole like the teeth of a giant. Their meeting at Marchman's, the little coffee shop on Wycham Street, had gone well enough. Amy had hugged him, and he had hugged her back. But when he tried to kiss her mouth, she turned her head deftly aside so that his lips landed on her cheek instead. "Kiss, kiss," as they say at the office parties. "So good to see you, darling." Ted Milner, blow-dried hair perfectly in place this morning and nary an alfalfa corkscrew in sight, sat at the table in the corner, watching them. He was holding the pipe which Mort had seen clenched in his teeth at various parties over the last 3 years or so. Mort was convinced the pipe was an affectation, a little prop employed for the sole purpose of making its owner look older than he was. And how old was that?
Mort wasn't sure, but Amy was 36, and he thought Ted in his impeccable stonewashed jeans and open-throated J-Press shirt had to be at least 4 years younger than that, possibly more. He wondered if Amy knew she could be in for trouble 10 years down the line, maybe even five. And then reflected it would take a better man than he was to suggest it to her. He asked if there was anything new. Amy said there wasn't. Then Ted took over, speaking with a faintly southern accent, which was a good deal softer than John Shooter's nasal burr. He told Mort the fire chief and the lieutenant from the Derry Police Department would meet them at what Ted called the site. They wanted to ask Mort a few questions. Mort said that was fine. Ted asked if he'd like a cup of coffee. They had time. Mort said that would also be fine. Ted asked how he had been. Mort used the word fine again. Each time it came out of his mouth, it felt a little more threadbare. Amy watched the exchange between them with some apprehension, and Mort could understand that. On a day he had discovered the two of them in bed together, he had told Ted he would kill him. In fact, he might have said something about killing them both. His memory of the event was quite foggy. He suspected theirs might be rather foggy, too. He didn't know about the other two corners of the triangle, but he himself found that foggery not only... They had coffee. Amy asked him about John Shooter. Mort said he thought that situation was pretty much under control. He did not mention cats or notes or magazines. And after a while, they left Marchman's and went to 92 Kansas Street, which had once been a house instead of a site. The fire chief and police detective were there as promised, and there were questions also as promised. Most of the questions were about any people who might dislike him enough to have tossed a Texaco cocktail into his study. If Mort had been on his own, he would have left Shooter's name out of it entirely. But of course Amy would bring it up if he didn't. So he recounted the initial encounter just as it had happened. The fire chief, Wickersham, said, "The guy was pretty angry." "Yes." "Angry enough to have driven to Derry and torched your house?" the police detective Bradley asked. He was almost positive Shooter hadn't done it, but he didn't want to delve into his brief dealings with Shooter any more deeply. It would mean telling them what Shooter had done to Bump, for one thing. That would upset Amy. It would upset her a great deal, and it would open up a can of worms he would prefer to leave closed. It was time, Mort reckoned, to be disingenuous again. "They might have been at first, but after I discovered the two stories really were alike, I looked up the original date of publication on mine." "His had never been published?" Bradley asked. "No, I'm sure it hadn't. Then yesterday he showed up again. I asked him when he'd written his story, hoping he'd mention a date that was later than the one I had. Do you understand?" Detective Bradley nodded. "You were hoping to prove you scooped him." "Right. Sowing Season was in a book of short stories I published in 1983. But it was originally published in 1980. I was hoping the guy would feel safe picking a date only a year or two before 1983. I got lucky. He said he'd written it in 1982. So you see, I had him." He hoped it would end there, but Wickersham, the fire chief, pursued it. "You see, and we see, Mr. Rainey, but did he see?" Mort sighed inwardly. He supposed he had known that you could only be disingenuous for so long. If things went on long enough, they almost always progressed to a point where you had to either tell the truth or carve an outright lie. And here he was, at that point. But whose business was it? Theirs or his? His. Right. And he meant to see it stayed that way. "Yes," he told them. "He saw." "What did he do?" Ted asked. Mort looked at him with mild annoyance. Ted glanced away, looking as if he wished he had his pipe to play with. The pipe was in the car. The J-Press shirt had no pocket to carry it in. "He went away," Mort said. His irritation with Ted, who had absolutely no business sticking his oar in, made it easier to lie. The fact that he was lying to Ted seemed to make it more all right, too. He muttered some bullshit about what an incredible coincidence it all was and jumped into his car like his hair was on fire and his ass was catching and took off. "Happened to notice the make of the car and the license plate, Mr. Rainey?" Bradley asked. He had taken out a pad and a ballpoint pen. "It was a Ford," Mort said. "I'm sorry, but I can't help you with the plate. It wasn't a main plate, but other than that..." He shrugged and tried to look apologetic. Inside, he felt increasingly uncomfortable with the way this was going. It had seemed okay when he was just being cute, skirting around any outright lies. It had seemed a way of sparing Amy the pain of knowing that the man had broken Bump's neck and then skewered him with a screwdriver. But now he had put himself in a position where he had told different stories to different people. If they got together and did a comparison, he wouldn't look so hot. Explaining his reasons for the lies might be sticky. He supposed that such comparisons were pretty unlikely as long as Amy didn't talk to either Greg Carstairs or Herb Creekmore. But suppose there was a hassle with Shooter when he and Greg caught up to him and shoved the June 1980 issue of EQMM in Shooter's face. Never mind, he told himself. We'll burn that bridge when we come to it, big guy. At this thought, he experienced a brief return of the high spirits he'd felt while talking to Herb at the toll plaza, and almost cackled aloud. He held it in. They would wonder why he was laughing if he did something like that, and he supposed they would be right to wonder. I think Shooter must be bound for Mississippi, for wherever he came from by now, he finished with hardly a break. I imagine you're right, Lieutenant Bradley said. But I'm inclined to pursue this, Mr. Rainey. You might have convinced the guy he was wrong, but that doesn't mean he left your place feeling mellow. It's possible that he drove up here in a rage and torched your house just because he was pissed off. Oh, pardon me, Mrs. Rainey. Amy offered a crooked little smile and waved the apology away. Don't you think that's possible? No, Mort thought. No, I don't. If he decided to torch the house, I think he would have killed Bump before he left for Derry, just in case I woke up before he got back. In that case, the blood would have been dry and Bump would have been stiff when I found him. That isn't the way it happened. But I can't say so. Not even if I wanted to. They'd wonder why I held back the stuff about Bump as long as I did, for one thing. They'd probably think I've got a few loose screws. Yeah, I guess so, he said, but I met the guy. He didn't strike me as the house-burning type. You mean he wasn't a Snopes? Amy said suddenly. Mort looked at her, startled, then smiled. That's right, he said. A Southerner, but not a Snopes. Meaning what? Bradley asked, a little warily. An old joke, Lieutenant, Amy said. The Snopeses were characters in some novels by William Faulkner. They got their start in business burning barns. Oh, Bradley said blankly. Wickersham said, there is no house-burning type, Mr. Rainey. They come in all shapes and sizes, believe me. Well, give me a little more in the car, if you can, Bradley said. He poised a pencil over his notebook. I want to make the state police aware of this guy. Mort suddenly decided he was going to lie some more. Quite a lot more, actually. Well, it was a sedan. I can tell you that much for sure. Uh-huh. Ford sedan. Year? Somewhere in the 70s, I guess, Mort said. He was fairly sure Shooter's station wagon had actually been built around the time a fellow named Oswald had elected Lyndon Johnson president of the United States. He paused, then added, the plate was a light color. It could have been Florida. I won't swear to it, but it could have been. Uh-huh. And the man himself? The average height, blonde hair, eyeglasses, the round, wire-framed ones John Lennon used to wear. That's really all I Did you say he was wearing a hat? Amy asked suddenly. Mort felt his teeth come together with a click. Yes, he said pleasantly. That's right. I forgot. Dark gray or black, except it was more of a cap with a bill, you know. Okay, Bradley snapped his book closed. It's a start. Couldn't this have been a simple case of vandalism, arson for kicks? Mort asked. In novels, everything has a connection, but my experience has been that in real life, you know, things sometimes just happen. It could have been, Wickersham agreed, but it doesn't hurt to check out the obvious connections. He dropped Mort a solemn little wink and said, sometimes life imitates art, you know. Do you need anything else? Ted asked them, and put an arm around Amy's shoulders. Wickersham and Bradley exchanged a glance, and then Bradley shook his head. I don't think so, at least not at the present. I only ask because Amy and Mort will have to put in some time with the insurance agent, Ted said. Probably an investigator from the parent company as well. Mort found the man's southern accent more and more irritating. He suspected that Ted came from a part of the South several states north of Faulkner country, but it was still a coincidence he could have done without. The official shook hands with Amy and Mort, expressed their sympathy, told them to get in touch if anything else occurred to either of them, and then took themselves off, leaving the three of them to take another turn around the house. "I'm sorry about all of this, Amy," Mort said suddenly. She was walking between them and looked over at him, apparently startled by something she had heard in his voice. Simple sincerity, maybe. "All of it. Really sorry." "So am I," she said softly, and touched his hand. "Well, Teddy makes three," Ted said with solemn heartiness. She turned back to him, and in that moment Mort could have cheerfully strangled the man until his eyes popped out jittering at the ends of their optic strings. They were walking up the west side of the house toward the street now. Over here had been the deep corner where his study had met the house, and not far away was Amy's flower garden. All the flowers were dead now, and Mort reflected that was probably just as well. The fire had been hot enough to crisp what grass had remained green in a 12-foot border all around the ruin. If the flowers had been in bloom, it would have crisped them as well. And that would have been just too sad. It would have been... Mort stopped suddenly. He was remembering the stories. The story. You could call it sowing season. Or you could call it secret window, secret garden. But they were the same thing once you took the gewgaws off and looked underneath. He looked up. There was nothing to see but blue sky. At least now. But before last night's fire, there would have been a window right where he was looking. It was the window in the little room next to the laundry. The little room that was Amy's office. It was where she went to write checks, to write in her daily journal, to make the telephone calls that needed to be made. The room where, he suspected, Amy had several years ago started a novel. And when it died, it was the room where she had buried it, decently and quietly, in a desk drawer. The desk had been by the window. Amy had liked to go there in the mornings. She could start the wash in the next room and then do paperwork while she waited for the buzzer which proclaimed it was time to strip the washer and feed the dryer. The room was well away from the main house, and she liked the quiet, she said. The quiet and the clear, sane morning light. She liked to look out the window every now and then at her flowers growing in the deep corner formed by the house and the study L. And he heard her saying, "It's the best room in the house, at least for me, because hardly anybody ever goes there but me. It's got a secret window, and it looks down on a secret garden." "Mort?" Amy was saying now, and for a moment Mort took no notice, confusing her real voice with her voice in his mind, which was the voice of memory. But was it a true memory or a false one? That was the real question, wasn't it? It seemed like a true memory. But he had been under a great deal of stress even before Shooter and Bump and the fire. Wasn't it at least possible that he was having a recollective hallucination? That he was trying to make his own past with Amy in some way conform to that goddamn story where a man had gone crazy and killed his wife? Jesus, I hope not. I hope not, because if I am, that's too close to nervous breakdown territory for comfort. "Mort, are you okay?" Amy asked. She plucked fretfully at his sleeve, at least temporarily breaking his trance. "Yes," he said, and then abruptly, "No. To tell you the truth, I'm feeling a little sick." "Breakfast, maybe," Ted said. Amy gave him a look that made Mort feel a bit better. It was not a very friendly look. "It isn't breakfast," she said a little indignantly. She swept her arm at the blackened ruins. "It's this. Let's get out of here." "The insurance people are due at noon," Ted said. "Well, that's an hour from now. Let's go to your place, Ted. I don't feel so hot myself. I'd like to sit down." "All right." Ted spoke in a slightly nettled, no need to shout tone, which also did Mort's heart good. And although he would have said at breakfast that morning that Ted Milner's place was the last one on earth he wanted to go,
He accompanied them without protest. They were all quiet on the ride across town to the split level on the east side where Ted hung his hat. Mort didn't know what Amy and Ted were thinking about, although the house for Amy and whether or not they'd be on time to meet the Wallas from the insurance company for Ted would probably be a couple of good guesses. But he knew what he was thinking about. He was trying to decide if he was going crazy or not. Is it real, or is it Memorex? He decided finally that Amy really had said that about her office next to the laundry room. It was not a false memory. Had she said it before 1982, when John Shooter claimed to have written a story called Secret Window, Secret Garden? He didn't know. No matter how earnestly he conned his confused and aching brain, what kept coming back was a single curt message. Answer, inconclusive. But if she had said it, no matter when, couldn't the title of Shooter's story still be simple coincidence? Maybe. But the coincidences were piling up, weren't they? He had decided the fire was, must be, a coincidence. But the memory which Amy's garden with its crop of dead flowers had prodded forth, well, it was getting harder and harder to believe all this wasn't tied together in some strange, possibly even supernatural fashion. And in his own way, hadn't Shooter himself been just as confused? How did you get it? He had asked. His voice had been fierce with rage and puzzlement. That's what I really want to know. How in hell did a big-money scribbling asshole like you get down to a little shit-splat town in Mississippi and steal my goddamn story? At the time, Mort had thought either that it was another sign of the man's madness or that the guy was one hell of a good actor. Now, in Ted's car, it occurred to him for the first time that it was exactly the way he himself would have reacted had the circumstances been reversed. As, in a way, they had been. The one place where the two stories differed completely was in the matter of the title. They both fit. But now Mort found that he had a question to ask Shooter, which was very similar to the one Shooter had already asked him. How did you happen by that title, Mr. Shooter? That's what I really want to know. How did you happen to know that 1,200 miles away from your shit-splat town in Mississippi, the wife of a writer you claim you never heard of before this year had her own secret window? Looking down in her own secret garden. Well, there was only one way to find out, of course. When Greg ran Shooter down, Mort would have to ask him. Mort passed on the cup of coffee Ted offered and asked if he had a Coke or a Pepsi. Ted did, and after Mort had drunk it, his stomach settled. He had expected that just being here, here where Ted and Amy played house, now that they no longer had to bother with the cheap little town line motels, would make him angry and restless. It didn't. It was just a house. One where every room seemed to proclaim that the owner was a swinging young bachelor who was making it. Mort found that he could deal with that quite easily, although it made him feel a little nervous for Amy all over again. He thought of her little office with its clear, sane light, and the soporific drone of the dryer coming through the wall, her little office with its secret window, the only one in the whole place which looked down into the tight little angle of space formed by the house and the L, and thought how much she had belonged there and how little she seemed to belong here. But that was something she would have to deal with herself. And he thought, after a few minutes in this other house, which was not a dreaded den of iniquity at all, but only a house, that he could live with that he could even be content with it. She asked him if he would be staying in Derry overnight. I'll be going back as soon as we finish with the insurance adjusters. If something else pops, they can get in touch with me, or you can. He smiled at her. She smiled back and touched his hand briefly. Ted didn't like it. He frowned out the window and fingered his pipe. They were on time for their meeting with the representatives of the insurance company, which undoubtedly relieved Ted Milner's mind. Mort was not particularly crazy about having Ted in attendance. It had never been Ted's house, after all, not even after the divorce. Still, it seemed to ease Amy's mind to have him there, and so Mort left it alone. Don Strick, the Consolidated Assurance Company agent with whom they had done business, conducted the meeting at his office, where they went after another brief tour of the site. At the office, they met a man named Fred Evans, a Consolidated field investigator specializing in arson. The reason Evans hadn't been with Wickersham and Bradley that morning, or at the site when Strick met them there at noon, became obvious very quickly. He had spent most of the previous night poking through the ruins with a 10-cell flashlight and a Polaroid camera. He had gone back to his motel room, he said, to catch a few winks before meeting the Rainies. Mort liked Evans very much. He seemed to really care about the loss he and Amy had suffered, while everyone else, including Mr. Teddy Makes Three, seemed to have only mouthed the traditional words of sympathy before going on to whatever they considered the business at hand. And in Ted Milner's case, Mort thought, the business at hand was getting him out of Derry and back to Tashmore Lake as soon as possible. Fred Evans did not refer to 92 Kansas Street as the site. He referred to it as the house. His questions, while essentially the same as those asked by Wickersham and Bradley, were gentler, more detailed, and more probing. Although he'd had 4 hours sleep at most, his eyes were bright, his speech quick and clear. After speaking with him for 20 minutes, Mort decided that he would deal with a company other than Consolidated Assurance if he ever decided to burn down a house for the insurance money, or wait until this man retired. When he had finished his questions, Evans smiled at them. "You've been very helpful, and I want to thank you again, both for your thoughtful answers and for your kind treatment of me. In a lot of cases, people's feathers get ruffled the second they hear the words insurance investigator. They're already upset, understandably so, and quite often they take the presence of an investigator on the scene as an accusation that they torch their own property. Given the circumstances, I don't think we could have asked for better treatment," Amy said. And Ted Milner nodded so violently that his head might have been on a string, when controlled by a puppeteer with a bad case of nerves. "This next part is hard," Evans said. He nodded to Strick, who opened a desk drawer and produced a clipboard with a computer printout on it. "When an investigator ascertains that a fire was as serious as this one clearly was, we have to show the clients a list of claimed insurable property. You look it over, then sign an affidavit swearing that the items listed still belong to you, and that they were still in the house when the fire occurred. You should put a check mark beside any item or items you've sold since your last insurance overhaul with Mr. Strick here and any insured property which was not in the house at the time of the fire." Evans put a fist to his lips and cleared his throat before going on. "I'm told that there has been a separation of residence recently, so that last bit may be particularly important." "We're divorced," Mort said bluntly. "I'm living in our place on Tashmore Lake. We only used it during the summers, but it's got a furnace and is livable during the cold months. Unfortunately, I hadn't gotten around to moving the bulk of my things out of the house up here. I'd been putting it off." Don Strick nodded sympathetically. Ted crossed his legs, fiddled with his pipe, and generally gave the impression of a man who was trying not to look as deeply bored as he is. "Do the best you can with the list," Evans said. He took the clipboard from Strick and handed it across the desk to Amy. "This can be a bit unpleasant. It's a little like a treasure hunt in reverse." Ted had put his pipe down and was craning at the list, his boredom gone, at least for the time being. His eyes were as avid as those of any bystander gleeping the aftermath of a bad accident. Amy saw him looking and obligingly tipped the form his way. Mort, who was sitting on the other side of her, tipped it back the other way. "Do you mind?" he asked Ted. He was angry, really angry, and they all heard it in his voice. "Mort," Amy said. "I'm not going to make a big deal of this," Mort said to her, "but this was our stuff, Amy, ours." "I hardly think," Ted began indignantly. "No, he's perfectly right, Mr. Milner," Fred Evans said with a mildness Mort felt might have been deceptive. "The law says you have no right to be looking at the listed items at all. We wink at something like that if nobody minds, but I think Mr. Rainey does." "You're damn tootin', Mr. Rainey does," Mort said. His hands were tightly clenched in his lap. He could feel his fingernails biting smile shapes into the soft meat of his palms. Amy switched her look of unhappy appeal from Mort to Ted. Mort expected Ted to huff and puff and try to blow somebody's house down, but Ted did not. Mort supposed it was a measure of his own hostile feeling toward the man that he'd made such an assumption. He didn't know Ted very well, although he did know he looked a bit like alfalfa when you woke him up suddenly in a no-tell motel. But he knew Amy. If Ted had been a blowhard, she would have left him already. Smiling a little, speaking to her and ignoring Mort and the others completely, Ted said, "Would it help matters if I took a walk around the block?" Mort tried to restrain himself and couldn't quite do it. "Why not make it two?" he asked Ted with bogus amiability.
Amy shot him a narrow, dark stare, then looked back at Ted.
Would you? This might be a little easier.
Sure, he said. He kissed her high on her cheekbone, and Mort had another dolorous revelation. The man cared for her. He might not always care for her, but right now he did. Mort realized he had come halfway to thinking Amy was just a toy that had captivated Ted for a little while, a toy of which he would tire soon enough. But that didn't jibe with what he knew of Amy, either. She had better instincts about people than that, and more respect for herself. Ted got up and left. Amy looked at Mort reproachfully.
Are you satisfied?
I suppose, he said. Look, Amy, I probably didn't handle that as well as I could have, but my motives are honorable enough. We shared a lot over the years. I guess this is the last thing, and I think it belongs between the two of us.
Okay.
Strick looked uncomfortable. Fred Evans did not. He looked from Mort to Amy and then back to Mort again with the bright interest of a man watching a really good tennis match.
Okay,
Amy said in a low voice. He touched her hand lightly, and she gave him a smile. It was strained, but better than no smile at all, he reckoned. He pulled his chair closer to hers, and they bent over the list, heads close together like kids studying for a test. It didn't take Mort long to understand why Evans had warned them. He thought he had grasped the size of the loss. He had been wrong. Looking at the columns of Cole Computer Type, Mort thought he could not have been more dismayed if someone had taken everything in the house at 92 Kansas Street and strewn it all along the block for the whole world to stare at. He couldn't believe all the things he had forgotten, all the things that were gone. 7 major appliances, 4 TVs, one with a videotape editing hookup, the Spode china, and the authentic early American furniture which Amy had bought a piece at a time. The value of the antique armoire which had stood in their bedroom was listed at $14,000. They had not been serious art collectors, but they had been appreciators, and they had lost 12 pieces of original art. Their value was listed at $22,000, but Mort didn't care about the dollar value. He was thinking about the N.C. Wyeth line drawing of two boys putting to sea in a small boat. It was raining in the picture. The boys were wearing slickers and galoshes and big grins. Mort had loved that picture, and now it was gone. The Waterford glassware, the sports equipment stored in the garage, skis, 10-speed bikes, and the old town canoe. Amy's 3 furs were listed. He saw her make tiny check marks beside the beaver and the mink, still in storage apparently, but she passed a short fox jacket without checking it off. It had been hanging in the closet, warm and stylish outerwear for fall, when the fire happened. He remembered giving her that coat for her birthday 6 or 7 years ago. Gone now. His Celestron telescope. Gone. The big puzzle quilt Amy's mother had given them when they were married. Amy's mother was dead, and the quilt was now so much ash in the wind. The worst, at least for Mort, was halfway down the second column, and again it wasn't the dollar value that hurt. 124 bottles wine, the item read. Value $4,900. Wine was something they had both liked. They weren't rabid about it, but they had built the little wine room in the cellar together, stocked it together, and had drunk the occasional bottle together. Even the wine, he said to Evans. Even that. Evans gave him an odd look that Mort couldn't interpret, then nodded. The wine room itself didn't burn, because you had very little fuel oil in the cellar tank and there was no explosion. But it got very hot inside, and most of the bottles burst. The few that didn't. Well, I don't know much about wine, but I doubt if it would be good to drink. Perhaps I'm wrong.
You're not, Amy said. A single tear rolled down her cheek, and she wiped it absently away.
Evans offered her his handkerchief. She shook her head and bent over the list with Mort again. 10 minutes later, it was finished. They signed on the correct lines, and Strick witnessed their signatures. Ted Milner showed up only instants later, as if he had been watching the whole thing on some private view screen.
Is there anything else? Mort asked Evans.
Not now, there may be. Is your number down in Tashmore unlisted, Mr. Rainey?
Yes.
He wrote it down for Evans. Please get in touch if I can help.
I will.
He rose, hand outstretched. This is always a nasty business. I'm sorry you two had to go through it. They shook hands all around and left Strick and Evans to write reports. It was well past one, and Ted asked Mort if he'd like to have some lunch with him and Amy. Mort shook his head. Now I want to get back, do some work, and see if I can't forget all this for a while. And he felt as if maybe he really could write. That was not surprising. In tough times, up until the divorce anyway, which seemed to be an exception to the general rule, he had always found it easy to write, necessary even. It was good to have those make-believe worlds to fall back on when the real one had hurt you. He half expected Amy to ask him to change his mind, but she didn't. "Drive safe," she said, and planted a chaste kiss on the corner of his mouth. "Thanks for coming and for being so reasonable about everything." "Can I do anything for you, Amy?" She shook her head, smiling a little, and took Ted's hand. If he had been looking for a message, this one was much too clear to miss. They walked slowly toward Mort's Buick. "You keeping well enough down there?" Ted asked. "Anything you need?" For the third time, he was struck by the man's southern accent. Just one more coincidence. "Can't think of anything," he said, opening the Buick's door and fishing the car keys out of his pocket. "Where do you come from originally, Ted? You or Amy must have told me sometime, but I'll be damned if I can remember. Was it Mississippi?" Ted laughed heartily. "A long way from there, Mort. I grew up in Tennessee. A little town called Shooter's Knob, Tennessee." Mort drove back to Tashmore Lake with his hands clamped to the steering wheel, his spine as straight as a ruler, and his eyes fixed firmly on the road. He played the radio loud and concentrated ferociously on the music each time he sensed telltale signs of mental activity behind the center of his forehead. Before he had made 40 miles, he felt a pressing sensation in his bladder. He welcomed this development and did not even consider stopping at a wayside comfort station. The need to take a whiz was another excellent distraction. He arrived at the house around 4:30 and parked the Buick in its accustomed place around the side of the house. Eric Clapton was throttled in the middle of a full-tilt boogie guitar solo when Mort shut off the motor, and quiet crashed down like a load of stones encased in foam rubber. There wasn't a single boat on the lake, not a single bug in the grass. Pissing and thinking have a lot in common, he thought, climbing out of the car and unzipping his fly. It can put them both off, but not forever. Mort Rainey stood there urinating and thought about secret windows and secret gardens. He thought about those who might own the latter and those who might look through the former. He thought about the fact that the magazine he needed to prove a certain fellow was either a lunatic or a con man had just happened to burn up on the very evening he had tried to get his hands on it. He thought about the fact that his ex-wife's lover, a man he cordially detested, had come from a town called Shooter's Knob, and that Shooter happened to be the pseudonym of the aforementioned loony or con man who had come into Mort Rainey's life at the exact time when the aforementioned Mort Rainey was beginning to grasp his divorce not just as an academic concept, but as a simple fact of his life forever after. He even thought about the fact that John Shooter claimed to have discovered Mort Rainey's act of plagiarism at about the same time Mort Rainey had separated from his wife. Question: were all of these things coincidences? Answer: it was technically possible. Question: did he believe all these things were coincidences? Answer: no. Question: did he believe he was going mad then? The answer is no, Mort said. He does not, at least not yet. He zipped up his fly and went back around the corner to the door. He found his house key, started to put it in the lock, and then pulled it out again. His hand went to the doorknob instead. And as his fingers closed over it, he felt a clear certainty that it would rotate easily. Shooter had been here. Had been, or was still. He wouldn't have needed to force entry either. Nope, not this sucker. Mort kept a spare key to the Tashmore Lake house in an old soap dish on a high shelf in the tool shed. which was where Shooter had gone to get a screwdriver in a hurry when the time had come to nail poor old Bump to the garbage cabinet. He was in the house now, looking around, or maybe hiding. The knob refused to move. Mort's fingers simply slid around it. The door was still locked. "Okay," Mort said. "Okay. No big deal." He even laughed a little as he socked the key home and turned it. Just because the door was locked didn't mean Shooter wasn't in the house. In fact, it made it more likely that he was in the house. When you really stopped to think about it, he could have used a spare key, put it back, then locked the door from the inside to lull his enemy's suspicions. All you had to do to lock it, after all, was to press the button set into the knob. "He's trying to psych me out," Mort thought as he stepped in. The house was full of dusty late afternoon sunlight and silence. But it did not feel like unoccupied silence. "You're trying to psych me out, aren't you?" he called. He expected to sound crazy to himself, a lonely, paranoid man addressing the intruder who only exists, after all, in his own imagination. But he didn't sound crazy to himself. He sounded instead like a man who has tumbled to at least half the trick. Only getting half a scam wasn't so great, maybe. But half was better than nothing. He walked into the living room with its cathedral ceiling, its window wall facing the lake, and, of course, the world-famous Mort Rainey sofa, also known as the couch of the comatose writer. An economical little smile tugged at his cheeks. His balls felt high and tight against the fork of his groin. "Half a scam's better than none. Right, Mr. Shooter?" he called. The words died into dusty silence. He could smell old tobacco smoke in that dust. His eye happened on the battered package of cigarettes he had excavated from the drawer of his desk. It occurred to him that the house had a smell, almost a stink, that was horribly negative. It was an unwoman smell. Then he thought, "No, that's a mistake. No, that's not it. What you smell is Shooter. You smell the man, and you smell his cigarettes. Not yours. His." He turned slowly around, his head cocked back. A second-floor bedroom looked down on the living room, halfway up the cream-colored wall. The opening was lined with dark brown wooden slats. The slats were supposed to keep the unwary from falling out and splattering themselves all over the living room floor, but they were also supposed to be decorative. Right then, they didn't look particularly decorative to Mort. They looked like the bars of a jail cell. All he could see of what he and Amy had called a guest bedroom was the ceiling and one of the bed's four posts. "You up there, Mr. Shooter?" he yelled. There was no answer. "I know you're trying to psych me out." Now, he was beginning to feel just the tiniest bit ridiculous. "It won't work, though." About 6 years before, they had plugged the big fieldstone fireplace in the living room with a blackstone Jersey stove. A rack of fire tools stood beside it. Mort grasped the handle of the ash shovel, considered it for a moment, then let go of it and took the poker instead. He faced the barred guest room overlook and held the poker up like a knight saluting his queen. Then he walked slowly to the stairs and began to climb them. He could feel tension warming its way into his muscles now, but he understood it wasn't Shooter he was afraid of. What he was afraid of was finding nothing. "I know you're there, and I know you're trying to psych me out. The only thing I don't know is what it's all about, Alfie, and when I find you, you better tell me." He paused on the second floor landing, his heart pumping hard in his chest now. The guest room door was to his left. The door to the guest bathroom was to his right. And he suddenly understood that Shooter was here all right, but not in the bedroom. No,
That was just a ploy. That was just what Shooter wanted him to believe. Shooter was in the bathroom. And as he stood there on the landing with the poker clutched tightly in his right hand and sweat running out of his hair and down his cheeks, Mort heard him. A faint shuffle, shuffle. He was in there all right, standing in the tub by the sound. He had moved the tiniest bit. Peek-a-boo, Johnny boy. I hear you. Are you armed, fuckface? Mort thought he probably was, but he didn't think it would turn out to be a gun. Mort had an idea that the man's pen name was about as close to firearms as he had ever come. Shooter had looked like the sort of guy who would feel more at home with instruments of a blunter nature. What he had done to Bump seemed to bear this out. I bet it's a hammer, Mort thought, and wiped sweat off the back of his neck with his free hand. He could feel his eyes pulsing in and out of their sockets in time with his heartbeat. I'm betting it's a hammer from the tool shed. He had no more thought of this before he saw Shooter. Saw him clearly, standing in the bathtub in his black round-crowned hat and his yellow shit-kicker work shoes, his lips split over his mail-order dentures in a grin which was really a grimace, sweat trickling down his own face, running down the deep lines, groove there like water running down a network of galvanized tin gutters, with the hammer from the tool shed raised to shoulder height like a judge's gavel. Just standing there in the tub, waiting to bring the hammer down. Next case, bailiff. I know you, buddy. I got your number. I got it the first time I saw you, and guess what? You picked the wrong writer to fuck with. I think I've been wanting to kill somebody since the middle of May, and you'll do as well as anybody. He turned his head toward the bedroom door. At the same time, he reached out with his left hand, after drying it on the front of his shirt so his grip wouldn't slip at the crucial moment, and curled it around the bathroom doorknob. I know you're in there, he shouted at the closed bedroom door. If you're under the bed, you better get out. I'm counting to five. If you're not out by the time I get there, I'm coming in and I'll come in swinging. You hear me? There was no answer. But then, he hadn't really expected one. Or wanted one. He tightened his grip on the bathroom doorknob, but would shout the numbers toward the guest room door. He didn't know if Shooter would hear or sense the difference if he turned his head in the direction of the bathroom, but he thought Shooter might. The man was obviously clever. Hellishly clever. In the instant before he started counting, he heard another faint movement in the bathroom. He would have missed it, even standing this close, if he hadn't been listening with every bit of concentration he could muster. One! Christ, he was sweating. Like a pig. Two! The knob of the bathroom door was like a cold rock in his clenched fist. Three! He turned the knob of the bathroom door and slammed in, bouncing the door off the wall hard enough to chop through the wallpaper and pop the door's lower hinge. And there he was. There he was, coming at him with a raised weapon, his teeth bared in a killer's grin, and his eyes were insane, utterly insane. And Mort brought the poker down in a whistling overhand blow, and he had just time enough to realize that Shooter was also swinging a poker, and to realize that Shooter was not wearing his round-crowned black hat, and to realize it wasn't Shooter at all. It was him. The madman was him. And then the poker shattered the mirror over the wash basin, and silverback glass sprayed every which way, twinkling in the gloom, and the medicine cabinet fell into the sink. The bent door swung open like a gaping mouth, spilling bottles of cough syrup and iodine and Listerine. I killed a goddamn fucking mirror, he shrieked, and was about to sling the poker away when something did move in the tub behind the corrugated shower door. There was a frightened little squeal. Grinning, Mort slashed sideways with the poker, tearing a jagged gash through the plastic door and knocking it off its tracks. He raised the poker over his shoulder, his eyes glassy and staring, his lips drawn into the grimace he had imagined on Shooter's face. Then he lowered the poker slowly. He found he had to use the fingers of his left hand to pry open the fingers of his right so that the poker could fall to the floor. "We sleek it, coloring beastie," he said to the field mouse scurrying blindly about in the tub. "What a panic's in thy breastie." His voice sounded hoarse and flat and strange. It didn't sound like his own voice at all. It was like listening to himself on tape for the first time. He turned and walked slowly out of the bathroom past the leaning door with its popped hinge, his shoes gritting on broken mirror glass. All at once, he wanted to go downstairs and lie on the couch and take a nap. All at once, he wanted that more than anything else in the world.